From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Feast your ears on this. Several new restaurants consume the spotlight in Metro Atlanta this year, from swanky Mexican to ramen to good old Southern-style dishes. And each year, Atlanta Magazine's Year in Food considers those attention-getters, along with the less flashy, the more reliable, and the often surprising array of eateries. Mara Shaloup and Jennifer Zeman are writers and food critics for Atlanta Magazine. Mara has laryngitis, which doesn't play well on radio. So, Jennifer Zeman, you're going to dig into this feast all by yourself.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here so much. This has been another year of a lot of new restaurants, emerging chefs, a lot of good eating. But let's look at the overall ideas and themes, starting with the food, and then we'll get to chefs. What was their big food trends this year?
I noticed, I grew up in Atlanta, and I've been covering food for 15 years here now, and I noticed that we're seeing a lot more French restaurants. There was a dearth of French restaurants for a long time. Sorry, quality French restaurants. And I've noticed, you know, with Tiny Lou's, which is the new restaurant in the renovated Claremont on Ponce, the Bazzotti development, which has the Brasserie, which Remy Granger, who is, you know, an amazing French chef, is over there. And then there's, you know, new stuff coming down the pipeline with AIX, which is Nick Leahy and... And I think there's one more French restaurant, but that was definitely a big trend. We're starting to bring in a lot more French. And then Mexican has been on the rise, more upscale Mexican and more varied subgenres of Mexican cuisine, like Yucatan-inspired food at Estrella on the Beltline, Casa Cielo in Sandy Springs, and then we're looking at some other places coming up in the new year.
So what are you looking at?
There's a new place coming up. I don't know the name. It's unnamed yet, and it's going to be another upscale Mexican concept.
So how about chefs? Any big rising stars?
You know, I feel like it was kind of an average year for rising stars, unfortunately. I noticed that the kind of national attention, interestingly enough, that Atlanta was getting was a lot of our more pop-up chefs, a Sichuan restaurant in the middle of Buford Highway, way, way, way up in like this little strip mall. He's been nominated for Beard Awards at Masterpiece. It's the Sichuan restaurant.
Is that who? What's the name of the
chef? His name is Ri Liu, mm-hmm. And I could be mispronouncing it because I'm not Chinese. I'm sorry. But he is a really well-trained chef who's does these intricate vegetable carvings and vegetable juice-infused dumplings that turn the color green. Mm. But he is a talent, and him and then, you know, the chef of Talat, who's opening his new restaurant, which will finally be his first bricks and mortar.
Is that Parnasse Savant?
Yes.
I'm not sure if I'm saying that properly.
Yes, we're doing our best.
So that was another pop-up place that's turning into a restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Another trend. Yeah.
Is it? Mm-hmm. That's happening in more and more places.
Yeah, Jarrett Stiber of Eat Me, Speak Me, he's going to be opening his own brick and mortar. And he was really one of the first chefs who was at Gatto Bisco, which is where Parnasse started as well.
And you also highlighted Brian So from Spring, not right in town Atlanta, but in Marietta.
Yeah, I love his food. He has a really unique perspective. He opened a restaurant in Marietta because that's close to where he grew up. Mm-hmm. And he's a Korean-American chef, but his food is almost Southern in a way because he's using, you know, what is in season in the South. And it's really clean. He makes the most amazing bread that they give you with like room temperature butter. And it's an unassuming restaurant. And the price point is also great. I mean, it's right where you want to see it. You're not going to be blowing it out for $200 for two people.
Another pop-up that you all liked is Marciela Vega's place. Mm-hmm. What does she do?
Marciela, I've been following her on social media for quite some time. In fact, I was kind of stalking her. She is a Mexican-American chef with, you know, just she's kind of had her hands in lots of different pots, but she's just an absolute creative cook. She's, as I said, of Mexican descent, and so am I. And she has been doing all this plant-based food. She started with tamales at pop-ups. I think it was around the time there was the earthquake in Mexico City. She did a benefit for that, and I think it just kind of started snowballing after that for her.
So this has been, you talked about social media. Obviously, social media is playing a really different role in your trade these days, mm-hmm. when you're seeing responses from people. Is that one of the indicators that you're looking at for how a restaurant is doing?
I mean, I definitely, I mean, not how a restaurant was doing is doing, but more just kind of like taking a temperature for what's happening in Atlanta, what people are really interested in. I can see on social media engagement, you know, what people love. You know, people really love like Shaolong Bao, those soup dumplings. You know, they love tacos.
What's not to love?
You know, so you can see kind of, it kind of helps you adjust your coverage.
And how about the sort of, I have a friend who says, I don't go into any restaurants that are made for Instagram. You know, that the aesthetics, to be photographed within a place, any place come into mind that you would love to be photographed or is most Instagrammable?
I mean, that was actually one of the things that I noted about Momonoke, which I told you about in my list. It's Jason Liang and his wife, Ching Yao, who is the pastry chef. And you go into that little jewel box of a restaurant and it just feels like you're in the middle of Tokyo or Taipei. It's beautiful and really curated. But I mean, I don't see anything wrong with that. like at Gu's on Buford Highway right now, they have this contraption they serve you your noodles on that makes it look like the noodles are suspended in midair. And I think it's fun. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with having fun when you're eating.
And you, there was another husband and wife team that you really liked that do Laotian food, mm-hmm. Laos food from
yes.
Laos,
mm-hmm.
Which is funny. You know, you think of Thai or Chinese or Vietnamese food. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that's going to become a thing that people say, let's go out for Laotian food?
Snackbox was probably one of my top. Snackbox Bistro, which you're discussing, is one of my favorite restaurants of the year.
Wow, it's in Doraville.
It's in Doraville. It's in the Super 8 supermarket shopping center. It's really unassuming. But in researching the restaurant and its cuisine, I learned that most of the Thai food that you see in the U.S. is actually Laotian, with a little more sugar.
Hmm.
And there, that restaurant is just, I don't know what, they're just, it's just good. You know, I don't care so much about the environment where I'm eating. I'm definitely someone who's going to be on Buford Highway more than I am in Buckhead when it comes to food. I just really want to eat good food. They make really good, wholesome, clean food. Actually, I believe that she won Best Chef on Eater Atlanta this year.
Okay. So speaking of chefs, the post-Me Too movement on the national scene, you know, we've seen John Besh and Mario Batali fall. I'm just wondering if there are any, you seeing any of that repeated in the Atlanta food scene?
You know, I haven't seen much of the Me Too movement here, but I think there's been a kind of broader focus on the environment in which people are working. You know, women feeling safer, having more people of color in higher roles. We don't see quite enough chefs that are of color mm-hmm. in Atlanta, which is weird because that's not what Atlanta looks like.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, chefs want to have quality of life. You know, they have kids. Yeah, they it's been a notoriously tough industry to live in and to work in. And I think that there's been an overarching national vibe of just making sure that people working in restaurants are happy and healthy and have the resources that they need, whether they're women, men, or immigrants.
Yeah, it's not a restaurant known for work-life balance, certainly.
No, it's not.
We're talking about the Year in Food with Jennifer Zeman from Atlanta Magazine, and we would love to hear from you. Which new restaurants did you try this year, and how was your experience? You can let us know on our Facebook group or leave us a voicemail. We're at 404-500-9847. Well, it was certainly good a year for brunch eateries,
yes.
Given the mimosa bill. Any favorites or standouts for brunch for you?
I just went to Lloyd's Bar and Lounge over in DeKalb Avenue, which opened a couple of weeks ago this past Sunday. And it's got this weird, like, not weird, but really, like, weirdly cool 70s throwback vibe when you go in. It's lots of wood paneling, these little screens that have, like, specials with, like, cowboys on them. And, like, everything that we ate was $10 and under, which you can't really beat.
Well, all right. How about cocktail culture, if you want to talk about spending a lot of money very quickly. Any favorite standouts in there in that end?
Yeah, I mean, Watchmen opened up from the Kimball House Boys this year, and anything that they ever do, I will support. They have an amazing painkiller there, which they use Navy Strength Rum. I did not realize that there's such a thing
rum.
As Navy Strength Rum. Like,
it explains so much.
It really does. I mean, the seas are hard. But that, and then it comes in this amazing tin cup that has the recipe printed on it. I love having drinks there. Paper Crane Lounge, which is above Stable House, was also a notable cocktail lounge that opened this year, and I really like them a lot.
Okay, so if you're looking at the lines, let's say this was the year for Hattie B's. My goodness. Along with some few snarky social media posts about what chumps they are for waiting that long in line. But what do you think? Is it worth it?
I mean, I went and I waited. Yeah, I thought it was really cool. Atlanta's not really the type of city that waits in line for restaurants. So it was definitely neat to see. And I love that they converted that old building that had been sitting there, you know, empty forever. Yes, they're from out of town, but I'm not the kind of person that's like, no out-of-towners. But I do have a trick. If you don't want to wait in the line, you can order them on Postmates.
You've just changed the whole game.
And it holds up well in delivery.
Well,
so.
It's fried chicken.
Yeah, so.
And there was more Southern comfort food on the menu at Lloyd's, which you mentioned, the place with the sort of 70s vibe. Okay, so what else is looking really good to you? And how about in the healthy, you know, sort of vegan or gluten-free range?
Well, Recess opened from the Castellucci Group.
That's down at the Croag Street Market,
which is down at Croag Street Market. And it's kind of in line with that upbeat restaurant over in Howell Mill, Westside area. Yep. You know, grain bowls, salads, tonics. I really enjoy the flavor combinations they do at Recess. Flower Child opened. I believe it's owned by the same people who own True Food out of Dallas. And it's kind of, you know, I see those restaurants as utilitarian. I don't believe that food has to always be experiential. I believe that sometimes for lunch, you just need a good salad. And these places provide you that.
Do people call you up all the time and say, where should I go have dinner?
Yes,
where should I go
but
lunch?
I have a rule.
What?
You have to use my recommendation. Or you lose the right.
We have to offer proof. How about in the sort of, let's say, chef-owned restaurants? Has that continued to be a trend?
I think so. And it goes back to what I was saying that people, chefs, and I just feel like it seems like every chef I know has a kid right now, a young kid just like myself. And I think they want a quality of life. I just feel like people are not settling for these crazy hours and these drug and alcohol fueled environments anymore. I feel like people, like being a chef doesn't have the same stigma it used to. You're not just someone slinging food for somebody. You're an artist. And I believe artists should have good life.
One of those that you picked out on the list for chef-owned places, or at least co-owned, is White Bull in Decatur. And we spoke with Pat Pascarella, the chef there. It was just terrific. But why is it a standout for you?
I mean, it's just a nice addition to the Decatur food scene, you know, that Mediterranean. It's a slightly different, you know, and anytime people are doing things that are not just double-cut pork chops over mashed potatoes, you know, you try to support it.
Oh, and they, like, mill their own flour and make their own butter. It's pretty devoted. All right, some new restaurants we should put on our radar for 2019.
First and foremost, that would be Zeb Stevenson's Redbird. Zeb was, up until it was sold, Watershed's main guy. He's not really a Southern chef, but he's, like, such a vegetable guy that I think he's gotten that reputation, especially because he was at Watershed and it's such a Southern restaurant. But he is going to be doing Redbird, which he says is not going to be Southern, and really rely on, you know, whatever ingredients he feels like using. And it's going to be over in the West Side in the former Bacchanalia space.
All right. So one to look forward to and many to look back at. Another year in foods. Jennifer Zeman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
She's written about the most important things that happened in Atlanta's restaurant scene this year for Atlanta Magazine. And since we're talking about food, Tribe Called Quest is bringing us out with Ham and Eggs. Coming up, when Mark Hogenkamp's world was stolen from him, he created his own. We're going to talk to the Atlanta man who helped this reclusive artist get his work out to the art world, and now moviegoers with the film Welcome to Marwin. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2000, Mark Hogenkamp was so brutally beaten by five men that he was left with no memory. Besides relearning to walk and talk and to write, Hogenkamp imagined a new past. He built a detailed miniature town where he acts out World War II-era storylines using dolls. And then he photographs them. The vignettes follow his alter ego, Hoagie, a pilot who lands near the imaginary Belgian town of Marwencall.
I came flying over in my P-40 Warhawk on fire. And I saw a flat field down below, and I crash landed it.
That is Mark Hogenkamp from the documentary Marwencall. In his story, Nazis swept the town, leaving behind 27 Barbie doll-like women.
I was thinking, boy, what a lucky guy I am. So they gave me my own place, my own building, which I turned into a bar.
It was my guest David Noggle who first encouraged Hogan Camp to share those realistic photos beyond his small upstate New York town. That led to an art magazine publication, gallery shows, the documentary, and now Welcome to Marwen, a Hollywood film starring Steve Carell as Hogan Camp, along with Janelle Monáe, Leslie Mann, and Diana Kruger as his characters come to life.
I got beaten within an inch of my life for no reason.
One foot in front of the other. You got it, Mark.
Embrace the pain.
But I've created a world where I can heal.
What is all of this?
Welcome to Marwen.
And it opens in theaters across the country this weekend. David Noggle is now an Atlanta-based photographer and director, and he's head of R&D Studios, a content creator. And he continues to have a knack for finding reclusive artists. David, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Virginia.
Well, you and your wife were living in rural New York State when you first noticed Mark Hogan Camp. What was your first impression?
Well, I saw him a couple of times. You know, it was extremely rural, so we didn't really see a lot of people around. And I would see him walking up and down the street occasionally, riding either his bicycle or dressed in World War II regalia. And he would appear to be carrying something or dragging something behind or with a stick. And I was really curious about what was going on. So I had to pull over and stop to talk to him.
And what was he dragging behind him?
Let's see. Well, probably the third time I saw him, I actually drove by and took a quick still just to see what was going on. And it appeared to be not a remote control car or something, but it was a 1/6 scale G.I. Joe Jeep. And it was filled with characters.
And how did you first talk to him?
Well, I pulled up ahead strategically and let him sort of walk up on me. And there was a pond nearby, so I was taking photos there. And I just started a conversation and said, tell me about your Jeep. You know, what's going on? He told me that they're all based on characters that he has in this little town called Marwen Call. And they're people, they're friends and family and people he works with. And that led to other conversations.
Did you get a glimpse of Marwen Call at that point?
I did not. I was kind of I was trying to figure out what his motivation was. And I was really struck by the fact that he said, you know, I take photos of these people, my characters in 1/6 scale, and just to show people that I know, that I work with, the realism and how, you know, what an amazing likeness it is.
So he shared those photographs with you. Can you describe what this town looked like?
Yeah, it was kind of hard to tell because, you know, I told him where I lived. I still had no idea where he lived. I would just see him walking down this rural road. And he dropped this envelope in my mailbox with about 25 photos. You could not tell it was 1/6 scale, first of all, because of the depth of field and the eye line. He basically set up these compositions. It looked like you were there. He would hide the seams of the plastic molding. You couldn't see the outbuilding in the background. It was just, there were so many little elements that were strategically placed, just like a DP, that made it so believable that I could not believe these were dolls.
So he's got a church, he's got a shop, he's got a bar called the Ruined Stocking.
That's correct.
You can see snow in these road signs. What kind of scenes were going on inside of them?
Oh, wow. Well, the bar was the first piece, the first structure he started working on. And he said, you know, I always wanted to have my own bar, and this was a chance for me to have it. And I was going to be there managing things. I'm always there. I'm always present, which is a big deal for him. And he also said there was not going to be any danger. You know, I wanted to protect everybody. This is a safe place. And then he proceeded to build additional buildings on the property to keep the bar company, as he says.
Well, so Marwen Call is called Marwen in the Hollywood feature film. But in Jeff Malmberg's documentary, Marwen Call, we see Mark Hogan Camp. He lives in this, you know, jam-packed trailer, chain-smoking all the time. And he works at the Anchorage. There's a bar. He makes meatball sweeps and cleans up a few hours a week. And we meet some of his colleagues and neighbors who he has also created alter egos for. Here is Hogan Camp describing why.
Everybody at one time or another wishes they had a double that could do the things that they could never do. So what I do is, with alter egos, I tell my friends, you can be anybody you want, you can do anything you want in my town. Have as many girls as you want. I only have 27 Barbies, so we gotta keep enough for the other dudes.
Mark also made an alter ego of you. He made one of his mom, the neighbor he has a crush on. What do people in town think of this? And is it maybe different for women?
Sure it is. You know, that's an interesting line to point out. He would bring in these photographs that he'd set up, the same, similar to photographs that he'd shared with me. And a lot of them were of some of the waitresses or the hostesses at the restaurant that he worked at. You know, they didn't know quite how to take it. Like, he wanted to talk about, hey, you know, I've brought you to life, and it looks just like you, and look what you did, and this is how you're a bigger part of Morrowind Call. And he wanted to actually post these in the back of the kitchen. And they said, I just don't feel like that's appropriate.
Hmm.
That should be pictures of our family and friends. And his reply was, well, these are my friends. This is my family. This is what I know.
So is there a distinction here for him between fantasy and reality? I mean, he's describing in Morrowind Call a doll, Anna.
So who's that?
Anna. That's Anna. My favorite female doll. I wish that you would come alive. I won a photo contest, and with that money, I bought Anna.
When I first got the doll, I fell in love with her face, so much that I had to paint makeup on her.
And being that I'm alone in life, I figure, well, at least my alter ego can have a girlfriend.
I wish you'd come alive. He lays her down in a little bed with three other dolls every night and, you know, says, I love you at the end of the night. What's going on for him?
Well, you know, I talked to him recently and he says that he still puts them to sleep and he gives them all kisses and he says, I love you. And, you know, when you're talking to him about it, where you hear his description of these dolls, he'll pause and say, you know, look, I'm not crazy, you know. This is just, these are my friends. This is my family. This is my immediate connection.
Well, you've spent a lot of time with him. Did you ever look at him acting out these scenes of Nazis coming and sweeping in a town and torturing Hoagie, his character, in a church? Five Nazis, by the way, and there were five teenagers who did kick his head in, as he says. Did you ever think he is crazy?
Well, you know, he had to figure out his own way of helping himself. After the attack, New York State disability sort of ran its course, and he still felt like he needed his creativity back. So he kind of created his own rehabilitation where he would do things like engineer and put these towns together with only manual screwdrivers and not using any power tools. Mm-hmm. And he wanted it to all be really authentic, and it was just his way of, like, doing multiple things at one time.
The level of detail is absolutely amazing. He shows a little tiny gun, you know, that has a clip.
Everything's real. The slide on the 45, the hammer, the clip even comes out. So that adds to my, you know, ferocity of getting into it, you know, into the story, because I know everything works. I almost know what everything, what every satchel's carrying, you know, that's grenades, you know. And here we have money, the detonator, and then certificate of ownership that I made up myself for my doll figure to carry around, because this proves I own the bar then.
It really is something to behold. But what do we know of him before the attack?
He kept extensive journals and a lot of sketches, and he was a great artist, had a really great hand, and was very descriptive of his words. And it's just he's really capturing the anguish of a lot of his depression and some battles with alcoholism. But he basically had these as a reference to go back and try and figure out, God, what kind of guy was I? Because he had lost all memory of even being previously married. He lost memory of what a great artist he was and what it felt like to be close to someone.
Welcome to Morrowind opens in theaters this weekend. And in it, Steve Carell stars as Mark Hogenkamp, a man who rehabilitated himself after a violent attack by making a miniature World War II-era town. And my guest is Atlanta-based photographer and content creator David Noggle, who helped get Hogenkamp's photos of this town published. He does say, and there's transcripts or recordings of the attackers saying that they beat him up because he was a cross-dresser.
Since I can't remember what happened in the bar, what led them to beat me up, I was told that I told them I was a cross-dresser I believe they attacked me because I mentioned that I was a cross-dresser.
He no longer drinks anymore, but once he was out of a coma, he discovered that there were 280 pair of women's shoes. Well, what does this part play in his fantasy life?
You know, that's really hard to say. And in the documentary Marwan Call, it's a big shift in the plot. And that was something that, you know, when I met the filmmaker, I wanted to have his trust. This was something that needed to be handled carefully, was not to be made as a freak, as a cartoon character. And I wanted to make sure he was going to handle that with care, and he did. As far as any nuances of cross-dressing within Marwan Call, it's not really there. It's a little more vague.
At one point he talks about, well, let's hear, sneaking a pair of tights underneath his character.
Two or three times I put tights under his pants just to see how that felt. And I was like, no, I'm still, you know, I don't want to come out of the closet in my town yet. But my girls, they know me better than I know me.
Well, I've seen photos of market openings wearing women's shoes and pantyhose, so his secret is pretty much out. You met him and saw him and said, this man's an artist. His work should be out there, and helped connect him with Todd Lippy. This is Esopus magazine. It's a beautiful art magazine. What was the concern for you, however, that, you know, such a fragile man would be exposed?
Well, Esopus magazine is an amazing publication, and I had contributed to them before, and I thought this would be great content for them. And I really wanted the work to speak for itself. I didn't want to give a whole lot of background and context into the nuances of his personality, because I felt like that wasn't really part of the imagery at first. That sort of grew and became more of a part of his character.
Mm. And how has Mark dealt with the attention? You know, and now movie, has it changed his life?
Oh, Virginia, that's a great question. I actually called him on Friday, and it's amazing to hear him sound the exact same. Mm. I mean, he sounds the exact same in the same rapport that we have when I interviewed him 13 years ago. He's still doing the same thing. He's still creating. He still lives in the same place. The place looks the exact same. He still smokes like a chimney. And he's still creating. And that's part of my wish, is I wanted for him to be able to sustain a career as an artist and people respect him.
Mm. We should add that we were forbidden to speak with him contractually because of the studio. You know, he's got this big movie out right now. But your role, I'm curious about, you know, discovery is a very problematic term because obviously he existed before you met him. But you knew publishers, you had access to the art world. And now, you know, this movie has been made and there's a new book coming out and there's a major show in the works. What do you think your role is in sharing his work?
Wow. From the very beginning, I did feel responsible, just because I had shared this with a bigger magazine. And of course, I had no idea this was ever going to snowball and come to where it is. And so his best interest, you know, being able to have his privacy and to be able to express himself and to share his art was always everyone's number one priority. And he's decided to watch the film by himself. He was invited to a lot of screenings. And even Robert Zemeckis, the director, had rented out the local theater to screen the film. And he says, you know, this is my thing. I just want to watch it by myself. It's such a personal thing, and it's going to be really hard. And I just want to do this by myself.
Well, Robert Zemeckis, also the director of the film Forrest Gump, that is very dear to Georgians, having been filmed here. But you got written out of the film. So what do you get out of this? I mean, you've been documenting the work of another extremely reclusive artist. His name is Randy Jones. He's Randy S. Jones, sorry, from Augusta, Georgia. I mean, are you that guy that goes around talking to people who make art that other people wouldn't notice?
You know, it sounds like I'm kind of stalking people. And I probably am when I tell the story. But it's almost like I just have a curiosity and I have a knack. And I just follow through with it. That one day when I pulled over to actually strike up a conversation with Mark, he's like, you're the first person to ever pull over and ask me what I'm doing. You know, it was like people just drive by and honk or throw beer cans at me. And you were really curious, and I felt like you really cared. And I had no idea who you are, but you seemed interested in my story. And so I think that by giving genuine trust, I'm able to hear great stories and share some ways. And, you know, And I happen to have the tools to be able to share people's stories, you know, having film and video. So why not put that to use?
Well, what a story it is. And we will leave you with music from Marwin Call from the documentary film by Jeff Malmberg. As we thank you, David Noggle.
Thank you so much for having me.
David Noggle runs R&D Studios, the content creator in Atlanta, and he is the photographer who first helped Mark Hogenkamp's spectacular photographs reach the public. We'll put a link to those photographs at our website, gpbnews.org. And meanwhile, the new film, Welcome to Marwin, starring Steve Carell, Janelle Monáe, Leslie Mann, and others, is in theaters this Friday.
Making believe I'm talking to you. Wish you could hear what I say.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, the holiday season is here, and with it, long road trips, layovers, and delays. Our job here at On Second Thought is 94% listening. So we are bringing you some of the things that we have enjoyed hearing over the past year to bide your time wherever you find it. Stepping out from behind the scenes are producers LaRaven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, Elena Rivera, and Amy Kiley. And joining me in the studio right now, hello.
Hi.
Hey, Virginia.
Hello. LaRaven, you're a dedicated listener of The Daily, the New York Times Daily News Digest podcast, which is a lot of words. Now, which episode did you pick?
I picked the episode on the daily instant delivery. I listen to The Daily almost daily, of course. One day I came to work and Leighton was like, did you hear The Daily this morning? And she basically told me about this particular episode. And so the next day I listened to it on my way to work. And I have to tell you, I literally was crying and driving at the same time just because it opened my eyes to women who work in these strenuous environments under crazy conditions and warehouses. And it made me think twice about instant delivery. Like, before I push that button, like, do I really need this, you know, as soon? And I didn't realize how many people or how many women were losing their pregnancies, denied requests from their doctor's notes, and even, like, literally killing themselves, you know, doing the job.
Elena, you went in a very different, more entertaining direction with Dr. Game Show. This is a podcast where comedian guests play listener-created games and people call in and try to win prizes. So you were on an episode of this podcast.
Yeah.
Okay, let's hear it.
Oh, my gosh. So,
guys, you keep saying, Alex, will you edit this out to the room next door to us? And that room is empty.
Oh,
spoiler.
Oh my God, what is going on?
Is this show produced by ghosts?
The water is shaking on the table. The dinos are coming.
Wait, we're not hearing Elena on that podcast?
No, no. I'm not on that episode. That's actually the first episode I ever listened to, though. It's with comedian Jason Mantzoukas. He's been on, like, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, The Good Place, a lot of different shows. It's such a weird show to describe to people. Joe Firestone and Manolo Moreno host the show together. Joe is kind of like a worrywart. She's paranoid. The listeners are kind of trying to sabotage the show. Manolo has really low energy and barely can do his one job, which is just play a theme song for every listener created game. And then people call in. And so it's a really interesting mashup of this new medium of podcasting with this kind of old school call in format. The charm of the show is it's a little bit messy and it's a little bit weird. And then they'll have kids as guests. And so the kids kind of bring their own fun questions and energy too. And it's like a joy to listen to. And so when it drops on Wednesdays, it's usually like the first thing I listen to right before coming to work.
A little more serious, Leighton, a couple weeks ago, you texted us all to ask if we'd been listening to Bagman yet. This is a new podcast by Rachel Maddow. Here's the trailer.
The people in the room, they gasped. It then became clear what this was about. That's really, to use a legal expression, that's when the hit the fan.
This is a story that is not well known.
What stuck in my mind about it was this was in the White House.
And the fact of the matter was, he was a crook.
So, Leighton, why do you like this one?
Yeah, well, as you can hear Rachel Maddow saying, this is a story that's not well known. And that is because Richard Nixon, the president at the time, was under investigation simultaneously for the Watergate scandal. And this podcast, Bagman, focuses on Spiro Agnew, the 39th vice president of the U.S. And he resigned in 1973 after being investigated by the U.S. attorney
for the District of Maryland on suspicion of conspiracy, bribery, extortion, and tax fraud. Now, what you learn in history class, at least what I learned in history class, was that Spiro Agnew resigned and pled guilty for tax evasion. But it was a little bit more than that. He was taking kickbacks for giving contracts to people who were paying him off. And this is just a fascinating podcast for me as a history nerd. It also has a sound design that's really similar to Serial for me. It made me, you know, the music in there makes me say, okay, I have to find out what happened next. Ira Glass and Rachel Maddow had a big love fest on Twitter where Ira Glass said to Rachel Maddow, binge listening to Maddow podcast, hashtag bagman, and so impressed. What a great story, totally engrossing and suddenly relevant.
Such a character, this Spiro Agnew, and so indicative of an era of politics.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it shows that there are not really any new things happening ever in politics. They've all happened at least once before.
Well, I also chose a true crime podcast that did not have a dead girl in it in some way.
Goodness.
The Isabel Stewart Gardner Museum heist was a big deal when living in New England, and my dad used to live over it. He looked down in the courtyard when he was growing up. So it was a special place in his heart. This is in 1990. About $500 million worth of art was stolen.
Wow.
And two guys posing as policemen responding to an alarm, Rembrandt, Manet, and there have been people who have been spending their entire life since then searching for this art. Never a trace of it shown up anywhere, but obviously a lot of characters. So Kelly Horan, who is actually a friend of mine and a producer and reporter at WBUR in Boston, and Jack Rodolico, also a former colleague, put together this amazing story. The podcast, I think it's about 8 or 9 or 10 episodes. I can't remember. I gobbled them up so fast. But, you know, they've got characters like Fat Richie and the guys who, you know, the criminal network out of a body shop in Somerville. It's just wonderful and really good storytelling structure. And there's this one episode called Flim Flammer. And they talk to a guy in a museum up in like upstate New York, this faded little town with a museum. And this guy passing himself off as a Vanderbilt and a New York Times writer pulls into this town and suddenly, you know, hints as if he's going to give a lot of money to this museum. And here is the former director of the museum, Fred Fisher, I think his name is, talking about it.
For about an hour or so, he went on and on about how he's so interested in art and he was writing about art and he's particularly interested in art theft. And that was the beginning of a little bit of concern, because he went on and on about various thefts that he'd heard about, and, you know, it was clearly movie kind of stuff. Catwalkers, you know, walking on the ceiling and jumping in through skylights, and he read about these things, and he started to write an article, and it was basically he was trying to draw out of me about what's the security at the museum. And so I immediately, that was kind of the first red flag.
So he's just one of the many people they talk to. All right, Leighton, you have another podcast, Getting Curious with Jonathan Van Ness. What's that?
Okay, I am obsessed with this podcast, and I'm slightly embarrassed to admit it, but not too much, because I know that All Things Considered host Audie Cornish agrees with me about Jonathan Van Ness, the host. He was one of the Fab Five on Queer Eye. He was the grooming expert, and he has to be one of the most vivacious, uplifting people I have ever seen on TV or listened to on a podcast. So here's a clip.
You know, to start from the beginning, more broadly, it's like, what's going on with bees?
So in general, you're right. The bees are facing, it's hard to call it a mass extinction because there's a very technical definition for that, but definitely going through a major extinction period like many other organisms.
What's the getting curious part?
Okay, so this is a podcast in which Jonathan Van Ness interviews experts about anything he is curious about. So in this case, the episode was called How Can We Be Less Mean to Bees? It was all about...
That's an amazing
It was all about the extinction or the endangerment of bees, which, as everyone knows, we have to have fruits and veggies, everything that we eat, basically. Some of the other episodes that I loved are, what's the cutest way to fight climate change? And is Saudi Arabia... cute now? And who was the Beyonce of Renaissance art? I love this podcast. It's super accessible. He is hilarious. And yet I come away from every episode having learned a lot of new information.
Okay, so you're getting a background view of the highbrow thinking here on Second Thought with the producers. We're talking about the things that we loved listening to in this past year, and some of us still listening in some cases. I chose another podcast called Caliphate. This is Rukmini Kalamaki. She covers terrorism for the New York Times. And she, this is about her quest to understand ISIS. But this is really a podcast about reporting, I think, in many ways. I mean, we get stories of people who were recruited by ISIS and how what their hazing process was, which is just, you know, shattering to think of. Girls enslaved, horribly treated. It's a really unbelievable look inside. But really, what it is about her instincts and rigor as a reporter establishing and checking facts. And there's this guy that they speak to for a series of months, and she has to corroborate his story and comes up with this idea that something is not quite right.
So during this time,
we're on our way right now to a town that
I was going all over. I went to Jordan. I traveled to Turkey.
I'm standing outside on King's Road in London.
Over to London to cover the London Bridge attacks.
Outside the home of one of the suspects.
And so it wasn't until months later that I was finally sitting on a flight coming back from London, that I had a chance to pull up my notes and methodically go over what Huzaifa had told me. And it was at that point that I felt a sinking feeling in my stomach. Something was off with his passport.
All right. Oh, boy.
So,
I got chills listening to
this. I know. Mm-hmm.
Listening to this episode for this episode that we're making right now was, oh my gosh, I felt so anxious.
It's crazy. They go through his passport and they basically he said he left Syria before the caliphate was announced. But the truth is he was actually there and he wanted to distance himself from, you know, the horror of what came after that. But they, you know, they're on a whiteboard and squeegeeing things and coming up with timelines. But this is just like one story she's been chasing for months. And to me, it is a story about like how journalism is actually made, and if you're doing real fact-based journalism, the work that's involved.
A lot of whiteboards.
Yeah.
You need just like rooms of whiteboards.
And WhatsApp groups. I've seen that she is inside the ISIS WhatsApp groups even, just trying to monitor what they're saying. I think it is incredible. And this podcast really is scary to listen to sometimes. You think about how vulnerable she is being on the front lines of this too.
I know. And she's fearless, you know, confronting people. Okay, let's have a mood swing. Elena, we're a little far from the sound of the summer, but your favorite was Cardi B's I Like It, featuring Bad Bunny and J Balvin. All right, you bring in a little sense of summer with us.
Okay, so here's the thing about Song of the Summer. It needs to be something that, like, your mom can listen to, that you can listen to, that can play in the bodega, that can, like, play in your car. There's, like, a lot of qualifications for a Song of the Summer, in my mind, at
least. The world according to Elena Rivera.
The world according to me. And so, like, I think the thing that's amazing about this song is it's, like, takes this really classic sound and song that I've heard forever. It's obviously, like, that song, like, I Like It Like That is just, like, such a popular and well-known song. And then when that, like, kind of trap hit beats, every time it makes me, like, just have chills. And then she's obviously, like, combining these amazing things with these two, like, mega stars. And it's a song that, like, when I listen to it, it makes me think of summer still. Sometimes I'll put it on when it's kind of cold and just think, wow, I'm in summer now. I love this.
A transporting song. All right, LaRaven, what are you listening to in the dead of winter?
All year, Chloe and Hallie, these are my girls. They're also sisters. Their whole album is a mood. They're from Atlanta, and I love them just because they're so dope. I have three sisters, and the sisterly bond among them is just beautiful. Their vocals are great and harmony out of this world. I love the fact that they produced the album, and they have been hands-on all around. Here's a little bit of it. We just wanna have some fun. It's some love for everyone. Pass it around when you get done. That's the move, yeah, that's the one. We are, we are, we can't. And I think that that they're just speaking to millennials and Gen Z. They're basically saying you see a lot of people living out the status quo and a lot of politics and social justice issues going around, but everyone is looking at the future and they're saying, hey, we got this. We're cool. The kids are all right. And I love the fact that they're nominated for their first Grammys this year. They're proteges of Beyonce. Y'all know I love me some Beyonce. I just love how futuristic they are, and they set the tone and let others catch up to their waves.
And I guess following on that theme, Leighton, one of the songs that you are listening to right now is called Self Care.
Yeah, so this song is the first single released from the new album Canterbury Girls by the group Lily and Madeline. They are sisters, and I discovered them when I was probably at the end of high school or early college. Loved their music ever since. They were sort of discovered by Sufjan Stevens, who's another favorite of mine, and he signed them to his label Asthmatic Kitty Records.
Let's hear it.
I like this too. I have always found their sound to be so haunting, but here you hear, I don't know, a really soulful sound as well. I've always just related to them because we're about the same age, and this self-care label of the song, it's a buzzword right now. People are talking about self-care, but, you know, there's a hidden message in here because they don't actually say the words self-care in this song. They say, I can't make myself care. And I think it's a song about navigating early adulthood, relationships, friendships, and figuring out what it is you care about. So I just love this song. Can't wait for them to come to Atlanta in February to perform at Eddie's Attic.
So we've pulled our senior producer, Amy Kiley, out from behind the board to tell us a little bit about her, what, favorite Christmas carol?
This is actually my favorite piece of music of all time.
Whoa, what is it?
Yeah, it's actually Joy to the World, which is a Christmas carol, and people probably will know it when they hear it.
Joy!
Who's singing there?
This is actually the Robert Shaw Chorale, and it's one of the reasons that I love this piece of music so much. So it represents kind of the best of music. Robert Shaw, of course, is an icon to Atlanta classical music. The music of this is originally written by Handel, whom everybody knows. Lowell Mason arranged it, and he is one of the reasons we have music education in schools in the United States. And Isaac Watts wrote the lyrics, and he is really important to American music history. So it's kind of a merging of great minds, but anybody can sing it.
So this is something that, you know, if you go through any shopping mall or even a gas station, you can hear Joy to the World, right? At this time of year, especially.
Exactly.
Well, why do you like to sing them instead of listening to them?
Well, it's really important to my family's tradition. For years, my mom would play piano and play carols while I would sing them. We would also go to concerts, and I sing in a choir. And I love that anyone listening to that piece of music will probably recognize it. 300 years it's been here. O Come Emmanuel has been around for more than 1,000 years.
Wow.
We have these staples of our music tradition that have just transcended the test of time. And I think this one's going to make it to 1,000, too.
All right. Perfect way to leave you with Joy to the World. And that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by
LaRaven Taylor,
Leighton Rowell,
Elena Rivera.
And senior producer,
Amy Kiley.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for coming on the other side of the glass today, ladies.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. You can join the conversation. We're on Facebook and on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. This is On Second Thought.